Exactly. As you stretch and shrink your primary tuning coil, and therefore you're increasing and decreasing its inductance on the plate circuit, it means that now you will resonate that plate circuit at a slightly different setting of the tuning capacitor. That's all that really happens. But once that coil hits resonance, the primary coil, the amount of coupling it gives to the secondary coil is almost the same. It only moves by a secondary effect of changing the so-called LC ratio. It moves very slowly. So the evidence you're giving me, and you're going to be able to confirm it by now looking more seriously at screen grid current under full power output conditions, comparing 6 meters to 2 meters, that's going to tell you if it's loading. Your complaint is that 6 meters is not giving the same power output. If the screen grid voltage is the same, and the screen grid current is higher positive on 6 meters, it is a strong indication that 6 meters is not being as heavily loaded. Kind of opposite from common sense. Heavier loading or out of resonance makes the screen grid go more negative. That's just the way secondary emission of a screen grid of that class of tubes operates. So you'll be able to confirm that. In order for you to get heavier loading on 6 meters, I think you're going to have to make a mechanical change to that loading coil. And that may not be easy to do. And it's kind of academic, Rich. 65 watts versus 80 watts. You're about to say, gee, I'm losing 15 watts. You go through the mathematics, that might be 1 decibel. The guy on the other end will never know the difference. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Nick, I got a comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
I had a friend, Joel, and he was very involved with that radio, and so little pieces of what Rich brings up sort of reminds me that he did make some modifications. He more or less, I think, was coming up with same similar problems, and one of the changes he made, I know he put a vein type. That's what they called the variables those days. Well, maybe they changed the name now, but it was called a vein type variable. He put that across the link, across the coil, the tank coil. And then on the link coil, the output link coil, I remember him saying he changed the put-in capacitor there to ground. And that's how he was able to stabilize everything. In other words, he wanted both control of the primary and secondary of that link coil, Dick. I remember that as a, I don't remember whether or not, I think maybe it was even suggested by the Collins Collectors over.
Making some sense. Assuming that his link coupling tuning, link coupling capacitor, the loading capacitor, assuming it's working correctly, link type A to type B, I don't think is making a big difference. If you put some kind of a fixed high voltage air variable capacitor across some of the turns of the primary winding, would that make a difference in the loading? I think the answer is yes, but you're giving me lots of pieces of evidence that suggest the loading is a little bit too light on 6 meters. And most of these tubes give you a little bit more linearity with heavier loading, opposite of common sense. You would think that with the harmonics that come out with heavier loading, you would have less linearity. The way the tube works, it gives you a little bit more linear operation with heavier loading. So it would be a fun set of experiments to find out how to increase the loading on 6 meters, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and one more thing that K2KUR.
Go ahead, Mel.
I think, in fact, the VHF manual, that was a suggestion. You called yours a flapper type variable, you know, a flapper type. They made the same thing, I believe, out of it. They called it a vane type stick, but basically, it was based on the same principle. It was a homebrew capacitor, and I think that was part of the modification that was necessary for that to, like you say, bring that into resonance on both bands equally, putting the vane type at the input of the link and putting the regular variable capacitor to ground at the output of the link to ground deck over.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit like a capacitor divider network. And would that increase the loading? I'm not sure. The way the link coupling works is that the link is in theory only sensitive to the magnetic field going through the center of the coil of the link. So the way you increase the loading is not only to resonate that link coupling, but to also increase the magnitude of the magnetic field going through the center area of that coil. And so whatever modifications you can make to the primary resonator to increase that magnetic field will increase the loading. And nice fancy words, how do you actually carry it out? I'm not sure. The advantage of what I call flapper capacitor is that it has extremely low inductance, extremely high Q, and properly used, very high voltage tolerance without arcing over. So as a resonating device, which doesn't have any high current flowing through screw threads, and therefore giving you welding and galling and whatever, it can be an extremely linear, high Q, high performance type of air variable capacitor. That's why it was used on the parallel kilowatt amplifier. That's why it has no trouble holding back 39 kilowatts of resonant energy bouncing back and forth in the box when the box is putting out 700 watts. It's running at a loaded Q of something like 39, as I remember, the actual resonator circuit. And at 432 megacycles, you have no choice because the 14 picofarads at the plate of that tube or 4.5 picofarads, I think it is, 14 picofarads on the control grid. 4.5 picofarads on the plate is a rather high amount of capacitance for 432 megacycles. Back to you, Rich, and let us know how your experiments proceed. N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
All right, Dick, very good. I appreciate the information. It answers a number of questions for me. I think I'll go through the CCA, Collins Collectors Association, and maybe somebody, I think from what Mel said, they did some mods instead of trying to reinvent the wheel. All right, Dick, I thank you very much. K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, N2EO, another happy customer.
Hey, Mel, you got to send him another bill, Mel. Assuming he paid the last one. Okay, the next person on the list, I think was, did we go to John yet? I think we went to John, but I'm not sure. Oh, Fred. Freddie, we didn't go to Fred. KB2, Victor Bravo November, I think it is. Fred, from Manhattan, go right ahead, K2RIW in the TechNet. Alrighty, maybe Fred's not there. Is there another person trying to sign in? Because we're hearing a carrier periodically with no audio on it. K2RIW in the TechNet, standing by. Alrighty, is there a person who signed in to the TechNet and we haven't yet gotten to your particular question? Give me your call letters right now. Hey, Mel, the silence is deafening. Do you have another item in your mailbag you think we should go to? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Question, Dick.
Okay, question, Dick. Give me your name, call letters, and then proceed with your question.
KC2, WGB, John in Staten Island. After Mel's through with his next question, I just wanted to ask you an antenna question.
Why don't you ask it right now, John?
Yes, sir, I will. I was speaking to Glenn, QAQ, and I was asking him a question. When I get a linear, I have I spoke to you before about this antenna. It's a quad beam, it's a quad channel, four band diamond antenna, 6 through 40 meters. It's rated at 500 watts. If I have a 1,000 watt linear and run it only at 800 watts, and I parallel two of those with a T connector. What is your thoughts on that?
Okay, in the case of a antenna rated for 500 watts, if the manufacturer is telling you the truth, the 500 watts is a key down condition where you go through its time constant, and that's what it can tolerate. Any reasonable antenna that has a power limiting, most of the time, something is getting hot. And the amount of heat you develop is the number of watts you put into it, multiplied by the amount of time it takes to get up to its thermal time constant limitation. So that if you were lining up your transmitter into a dummy load, and then you flip over to single sideband operation, where your voice is only coming out of the machine one-third of the time, so to speak, I have no reason to believe that the antenna rated for 500 watts would have any trouble tolerating 1,000-watt peak envelope power sideband, normal speech, with a reasonable amount of speech clipping. That doesn't mean you can go over to radio teletype or some other very high duty factor kilowatt signal. So any reasonable antenna is not going to overheat. By the same token, you can take a dummy load rated for 500 watts, and for brief periods of time, you can put 1,000 watts through it. Just you can't do it key down for 3 solid minutes, if you know what I mean. So I think that amplifier, I think that antenna, one single antenna would take it. When you use a power divider, a high-efficiency power divider, and now you're putting, let's assume you had a 1,000-watt transmitter, and the power divider has got to obey the laws of conservation of energy, if it's really an even power divider, the maximum it can put to a pair of antennas on the output of the power divider would be 500 watts each, which would be safe key down forever, assuming the manufacturer told you the truth. So you've got two methods of protection here, controlling the timing or dividing the power, or doing both if you like. Now, there's a rare exception to what I just said. If the manufacturer did a very marginal design of the antenna so that something in the antenna arced over with voltage, then yes, you could do some damage briefly. That's rare. Almost all antennas that have a real power limitation, it is a thermal limitation. Some capacitor in there is going to get overheated when you put more than 500 watts in there for some significant number of seconds that it takes to heat up that capacitor. And the instantaneous peaks of sideband speech voltage does not do that. It doesn't have the timing. That's my belief on that one, John. KC2 WDG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. My other thought was, because it's a four-band antenna, and if I were to parallel two, would the slight discrepancy in tuning cause an issue?
What I think you're saying is that whatever you're using for power dividing might not give the same equal divide on 6 meters versus 40 meters. And that's a matter of how you design that power divider. That's one way of looking at it. Also, the antenna itself, where it's assuming the manufacturer is telling you the real truth, that it really has a 500-watt power limitation, that power limitation is going to affect one of those bands more than another. In the case of 6 meters, the highest frequency, if it was simple dielectric heating of a capacitor, quite possibly the capacitor would run hottest on 6 meters. Because the antenna has a finite length to it, it probably runs at a higher Q on 40 meters. So on 40 meters, somewhere the current in the antenna is probably higher than it would be on 6 meters. Your next question is, where does the antenna really have its 500-watt limitation? Is it on 6 meters or 40 meters or something in between? There I'm not sure, but there's ways you can find out. So is it really limited on only one of those bands is one question to ask yourself. And when you're using a simple power divider, how even is your power divider on each one of those bands? There's ways you can control that with the right kind of a design. KC2 WDG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, at least I know which avenues to check. Thank you for your time and for your answers. That's a lot of help between you and Glenn. I'll get this thing working. KC2 WGB. that now. Thank you.
Hey, you've got a fascinating problem there, John. As you make more measurements and more discoveries, please come back periodically and let Mel and I know how it goes, what you found out, and what you and Glenn are finding out. You guys are the real scientist types. Mel, I wonder if you've got...
Andrews, yes.
Go ahead, Wesley.
I have a question. Let's say you have a coil, and then the coil is made from the tube, let's say the copper tube, and you want to check all the possible properties of that tube. Isn't that the circle of that tube could be treated as the closed loop back to you?
Yeah, when you make a high power resonator out of copper tubing, because of skin effect, all of the RF energy is only flowing on the outer 1/10th of an inch of the copper at most of the frequencies you and I are likely to use. So how much heating you get of that copper tubing is a function of how much current you're putting through it and what is its diameter. If you decide to double the diameter of the copper tubing, that's one way of making it tolerate a whole lot more current. Another way is to change the LC ratio. I can make a resonator at your favorite frequency by taking the certain number of turns of copper tubing, which has some number of microhenry of inductance, put the right capacitor across the ends of that, and it will resonate at that frequency. And if I am fixed in the amount of voltage that I apply to that resonator, because I'm grounding one end and putting a tube on the other end, I've got another variable I can work with. Let me drop.
So what I was thinking is that if you take the tubing and it's, let's say, 1 inch in diameter or 1/2 inch in diameter, you have a factor of the tube by itself reacting as a closed loop, and then the number of winding of that loop by two.
Yes, you're discussing what's called the eddy current effect. As I increase the diameter of the tubing, which is creating more of an eddy current effect, and I'm winding the tubing around some kind of a coil form. If I'm using 1/2 inch diameter copper tubing, and I'm winding it around a coil form that's 3 inches in diameter, for instance, as I go from 3/8 diameter copper tubing to 1/2 inch diameter copper tubing, the same number of turns on the same coil form will give me slightly lower inductance when I'm using the larger diameter copper tubing. So to come up with the same number of microhenries, I'm going to need some extra turns or some extra diameter, because the larger diameter copper tubing does cancel a little bit of the magnetic field by what's called the eddy current effect. It's a somewhat minor effect in most cases, but you're right, it's really there. But once I choose my favorite diameter of copper tubing, let me drop, and once I choose the way I'm making the resonator, I'm using some number of turns of copper tubing that generates a certain amount of microhenries. I'm putting a certain amount of capacitance across it to resonate it. And now when it's resonating and I'm firing up the tube at one end and I'm grounding the other end, I'm putting a certain number of fixed volts from the plate of that tube across that resonator. I'm RF grounding one end with a bypass capacitor. In reality, I'm putting B plus on it, quite possibly. I'm now forcing a certain amount of RF current to go through that coil. In many cases, I have the freedom to change the inductance to capacitance ratio. If I decide to use a larger number of turns of inductor, which has a little bit more inductance in microhenries, therefore I'm resonating with a smaller amount of capacitance, and I still hit resonance. By definition, the same number of volts coming out of the tube being applied across that same coil is a smaller number of amperes of RF current flowing through that coil. because you could look at the coil all by itself. It has some number of microhenries, which gives it some amount of inductive reactance. You're putting some amount of RF volts across it. That creates some amount of RF current in amperes. If I use a larger inductor, which has a larger number of microhenries, which has a larger number of ohms of inductive reactance, and I put the same RF current, RF voltage across it, it's a smaller current. Therefore, it'll run colder. Another one of the variables you've got is LC ratio. Wait for the beep and go ahead with your comment. K2RIW.
How about a capacitive component? That's one question. And with the smaller tube and a bigger tube. And another one that I have is, how about if instead of one frequency, we develop a certain spectral frequency from two, then you're going to have a number of peaks of resonance because of that factor, because of this eddy current, and because of that loop actually reacting as a part of resonant circuit. Back to you.
If I was looking at a very simple parallel LC network, I've got some number of turns of copper tubing making a coil, and I'm putting a low inductance capacitance across that coil. In theory, that has only one frequency of resonance. In theory, that circuit does not respond to harmonics. That's a hard one to accept. Now I start making a variation of that. I take that capacitor across the coil, and I break it into two separate capacitors in series. I can do that, adjust the capacitors correctly, I'm back to resonance. I now ground the center tap between those two capacitors. My simple parallel LC network has now become a pi network. I connect the tube to the left-hand side, the anode of the tube. The first capacitor, a variable capacitor of the two in series, with the center tap grounded, that first capacitor, I call that the tuning capacitor. The second capacitor on the right-hand side, I call that the loading capacitor. And instead of grounding the right-hand side, the bottom of the coil, so to speak, I connect the antenna there. I've now, step-by-step, gone from a parallel tuning LC network to a pi network. You could say it's a capacitor-divider network, which allows me to change the loading. Properly built, most pi networks, again, have primarily only one resonance, and they don't really respond to other harmonics. Well, you add a real antenna there, and the antenna itself usually has more than one frequency which it responds to and resonates to, and you've got it going through a certain length of transmission line, which is a kind of an impedance inverter. And now things get a little bit more complicated, and yes, there will be some...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And when you add now those extra components, the real antenna with its multiple resonances, a length of transmission line, which is doing impedance inverting and impedance converting at certain frequencies, connected to a real pi network, in general, there's going to be more than one resonance there. But by way of a spectrum analyzer that you already own, you can measure whether or not there's a second or a third harmonic coming out of your transmitter. You could then decide to do something about it by putting in choke filters and so on, or changing the parameters of your network to get rid of that. So you've got the instrumentation there that can measure those harmonics. Most well-designed transmitters that you and I can buy, essentially all of those harmonics these days, are more than 60 decibels weaker than the fundamental power. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. All right, question. You have just the coil by itself. The diameter of the tube, let's say, is 1 inch. And then you don't have a capacitor. You use the sweeping generator, and you start to sweep from 0 to gigahertz. how many resonant frequency are you going to get? Is that coil going to react as a resonant circuit, reading the capacitance of it? And the third question is, would in any of these frequencies, that closed loop through which actually the eddy current flows, have any role to do? Back to you.
If I chewed nothing but a 1-inch diameter piece of copper tubing, that's what I think you're saying, and it's got some number of turns on some coil diameter, a few inches of diameter of coil, or maybe your coil has got a coil diameter of the coil form is 1 inch. I'm not quite sure what you're saying, but it doesn't matter. If I don't put a capacitor across the coil, the stray capacitance that's there because of its physical layout is a real capacitor, and it will resonate with that. So every coil has got a parallel resonance. Every capacitor has a built-in series resonance. The leads coming out of the capacitor have a small amount of inductance. They're in series with the capacitor that you can see, and therefore every capacitor has a series resonance. Every coil has got a parallel resonance. When you feed the coil all by itself, you've now got to worry about the fact that the instrumentation you put across the coil could be heavily disturbing it. If I'm using a certain kind of signal generator, for instance, to go across the coil, and the signal generator represents a 50 ohm source impedance, and I put it across the coil that at this frequency has 500 ohms of inductive reactance, the 50 ohm load created by my signal generator is disturbing the living daylights out of that coil. If I want to really measure what the coil is doing, in theory, I should not connect the signal generator directly across the ends of the coil. If the coil has 5 turns to it, for instance, I should tap up from ground 1 turn to put the signal generator there so that I am very lightly loading the coil so I can really measure the natural characteristics of the coil. When you connect instrumentation across a single inductor or single capacitor, you have to worry about whether or not...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You have to worry about whether or not the loading characteristics of your instrumentation is drastically changing the measurement you're trying to make. The most extreme case I can think of is the secondary winding of a Tesla coil. Any method by which you try to couple to that secondary winding is going to disturb the daylights out of it. The best I think you can do to measure the characteristics of the secondary winding of a Tesla coil is to stand more than a foot or two away from it with a probe of an oscilloscope, and by way of the distance to your probe to the top of the Tesla coil, that represents a 0.001 picofarad capacitor. The probe of the oscilloscope has a built-in 7 picofarads to ground. That voltage divider network is a capacitor divider network, and now you're essentially not loading the Tesla coil, and you can really make its measurements and display the voltage waveform on the oscilloscope, but just you'll have to use a scaling factor. The voltage out of that Tesla coil is so big that if you're using a voltage divider network that divides it down by 10,000 to 1, not to worry. There's more than enough volts left over for your oscilloscope to measure, but you have to worry about creating excessive loading that changes the characteristics of the thing you're trying to measure. So it's sort of a Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You got to be sure you're not changing the thing you're trying to measure while you're using your instrumentation to measure it. N2XJN, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, I have a great respect to the knowledge of yours. And the way that you actually explain things I believe it's very easy to understand by the people not really very much involved into the science of Tesla coil and all of the things that I'm talking about, but also to the typical ham radio operator from any other profession or interest. Question for you is, I'm trying to make a generalization. The resonance that I was talking about with ferro resonance, how in the world, in the ferrite, that actually consists the insulated particles pressed together to form the core, the ferro resonance could happen? Back to you.
A darn good question. I don't have a good answer, and I'm going to make a guess. Every magnetic circuit that is not in air, every magnetic circuit that consists of particles of magnetic material, laminations of magnetic material, any magnetic material, has what's called a BH curve, Baker-Hotel curve, where Baker is the amount of ampere turns of exciting magnetic field that you're applying to the material, and H is the amount of response of the magnetic material. And near zero, the BH curve is a straight line on a 45 degree angle on a properly set up piece of graph paper. However, as you go further over to the right with stronger and stronger magnetic excitation, every real magnetic material starts going into saturation. The curve starts, the 45 degree line on the BH curve, on the top right-hand side and the lower left-hand side, it starts curving over. And not only that, it starts curving over with hysteresis. If you're exciting it with, say, a 60-cycle sine wave, that curve over on the upper right-hand side is not just a straight line anymore. It's got one curve on the way up and a slightly curve on the way down, and there's area between those two curves. And that area represents power dissipated. So once you start getting into saturation characteristics, let me drop, of magnetic material, and if you simultaneously apply a little bit of DC bias to the winding around the magnetic material, you can now start getting into all kinds of nonlinear characteristics where it can become chaotic. That is to say, on the first five cycles, it responds one way, and on the sixth and seventh cycle, it responds some other way. Magnetic materials are capable of doing that. So some of my guesses involving the ferro resonance that you're talking about, I think involves partial saturation characteristics, partial hysteresis characteristics, partial magnetic retentivity. Almost every magnetic material, when you hit saturation, you start putting in a little bit of permanent magnetization. And it doesn't, once you remove the ampere turns of the exciting magnetic field, it might not come all the way back down to zero, because it retains some of the magnetic characteristic, very similar to a permanent magnet. So I think ferroresonance involved some of this, and therefore this non-linearity and these crazy characteristics can become chaotic. It can become a circuit that, when you plot it out correctly, makes a very complicated diagram. It's not just a simple BH curve anymore. That's my guess as to what's going on here. As you do further research in the websites that are available on the subject, you're eventually going to find out a lot more on this one. And tell us what you find out, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you for another guess. The permeability of the ferrite that I'm using is 2,000. Low frequency. How do you think permeability of the ferrite could actually change the characteristic of a resonative, I don't know how to say it properly, characteristic of this, or in this area? Back to you.
My understanding of permeability, and the permeability, I think you said 10,000.
No, 2,000. 2,000 is for fairly low frequencies. Now, the permeability of 600 is the one that is working with the higher frequencies. Back to you.
Now, I was first going to define permeability. When it comes to magnetic materials, excited at a particular frequency, excited at a particular magnitude of magnetic field, once you accept those limitations, what frequency and how much magnetization current or magnetic field you're applying in ampere turns, that's one of the units you could use, a material with a 2,000 permeability means that if you wound a coil around that material, the amount of inductance you would get in microhenries would be 2,000 times higher than if you wound the same coil in air. So a permeability of 2,000 means that the magnetic field flows through your material 2,000 times better than it would through air. That's one way of looking at it. So as long as you accept the limitations of frequency and voltage, that material will give you 2,000 times more microhenries for the same number of turns. But there's a trade-off here. Let me drop. As you go to higher and higher frequencies where you want to use your magnetic material, you have to worry about what is the size of each one of the grains. Because beyond a certain size, the eddy currents, depth of magnetic penetration, call it what you like, as you go to a high enough frequency, your individual grains become too big and they start becoming lossy, eddy current loss. You get around that problem by using smaller and smaller grains. You grind the magnetic material into finer and finer grains. Now your magnetic material can go to higher frequencies. That's the good news. But as you grind the material into finer and finer, smaller and smaller grains, and you make some kind of a mixture of this material, like putting it into an epoxy, you could, but they've used better materials. As the grains get finer and finer, and you put it into something that's going to bind them together into a fixed object, you're going to mold it, you now are ending up with less and less iron compared to binder. Because there is less and less iron and more binder when you're using finer and finer grains, that means the permeability goes down. The bottom line, let me drop, is that when you select the proper magnetic material for your particular frequency, the permeability that you can buy becomes smaller and smaller as you request higher and higher frequency. That's the trade-off. There's very little getting around that. No one has really solved that problem. I'd love to have permeability of 2,000 material at 1,000 megacycles. No way in hell. You can't come close. Very few materials have good magnetic characteristics at 1,000 megacycles. Very, very few. And the few that you can touch probably have a mu of 10 or 5, not 2,000. You just can't get there for a whole bunch of reasons. So that's the trade-off. Magnetic materials will save you some volume, less turns, higher Q, as long as you don't exceed the number of ampere turns you put into it, which starts saturating it, and as long as you're not going to too high a frequency. I don't think anyone has designed a very good high-power Tesla coil where ferrite materials are used in the secondary. I think they've never used anything but air, because any ferrite material there you think would save you some windings and get you better operation, but the loss of those ferrite materials at those extremely high frequencies that a Tesla coil really operates at, and the extremely high voltage. Let me drop one other thing here.
We better move on.
Yeah, every ferrite material has a maximum voltage you can tolerate across the material before you start arcing between the grains. So ferrite materials are good. They give you more inductance per package. But you've got three limitations: maximum magnetic field, maximum frequency, maximum voltage. Back to you for a quick comment on this one. Alex, here we go. I'm losing it, fellas. Wesley, back to you, and then we got to move on. N2XJM, K2RAW.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, Wesley first. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay. Thank you very much for your explanation, and Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple of quick things here to say about permeability. You know, you have mu sub O, which is the permeability of free air, and when you start adding ferrite materials, iron materials, nickel materials in between, and between your air gap, your permeability will increase. But basically what's happening is you're taking up some of the air gap and replacing it with another material, which is increasing the inductance per turn within that ferrite block area. Usually it's your cross-sectional area with respect to the path length, and you can increase the overall inductance with that. But there's another thing also to keep in mind when you're talking about Tesla coils. Can Tesla coils be made with ferrite materials? The answer is yes. And what's actually happening there is that they use saturable reactors. Basically, you're taking a ferrite material that has a property designed to go into saturation very, very quickly, store energy, and then when the field reverses itself, it will basically reset the amount of energy and release again. And what happens is during saturation is the material itself is not very, very lossy. So that's one of the little tricks to that one as well. KC2QIQ, back over to you, Dick.
Okay, let's have a couple more words on this one, Glenn. When it comes to the modern-day high-power Tesla coils, where they tend to have a real high-voltage transformer, the minimum usually is a microwave oven transformer or a ignition circuit from an oil burner, and that in turn goes through some kind of a network of spark gap capacitors and inductors. And I think you're talking about those series inductors making those that are ferrite in order to get just the right kind of kickback on the spark gap to give you a little bit better primary excitation to the Tesla coil. But within the Tesla coil itself, between its primary pancake winding and that great big tube of secondary winding, it is my guess that you tend not to put ferrite there. I think it's only in the primary excitation circuit that you're talking about ferrite materials. It's a guess on my part. And correct me on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I guess it depends on the size of the Tesla coil, the amount of energy, and how much material you're planning on using. Here again, if your inductance is very, very high, and you know, you can calculate your Bmax over the material and determine exactly what your losses are. But that's operating still within relatively the linear region of the ferrite. But what happens is when you put a ferrite into a square loop condition where you're saturating it, I think, Dick, we were talking about that before with magnetic amplifiers, with mag amps, you can run it in and out of saturation with a very, very square loop type of transformer core that will run very, very hard into saturation very, very quickly. Very, very small currents can drive a very, very hard saturation on the core. So you're basically starting off with high permeability. You put a small excitation current into it. That field, the field is still there. Remember, we were talking about that before. But the inductance of the material collapses almost immediately down to zero. So during that saturation period of excitation going in and out on field reversal, you can get some very, very interesting characteristics where the loss is relatively low.
Okay, so by using the right material, winding a coil on it, letting it saturate, it has some amount of inductance, it has some amount of current flowing through it. The total stored energy, in theory, is one-half Li squared, current squared times the inductance. Although when you saturate it, that inductance goes to zero. However, like a Ford spark coil, or like the ignition coil of an automobile, that stored energy, you can get it back in a hurry. So if it's an inductor in the network that's exciting the primary, proper use of ferrites on a small Tesla coil, I think, are appropriate. If I was running one of these 40 kilowatt type Tesla coils, I'm having trouble believing that ferrite is going to help me there. When you look at that so-called Oklahoma Tesla coil, where this guy can arc, 8-foot lengths and 10-foot lengths out of the secondary, I don't think he's using very much ferrite in that one. But and the ferrite itself for a large Tesla coil, I think it's not going in the primary winding of the Tesla coil or the secondary winding. Correct me on that one, Eric. Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I would have to agree with you. I mean, if you're trying to, develop one simply, that certainly not having to use the magnetic material within the coupled area of the Tesla coil, I think, is your best bet. Is it impossible to do it the other way? I would have my doubts on that. I mean, certainly I could look into it a little bit more, but I would say that if it's going to be done, it's going to have to be done with a very, very sharp square loop material, something like a tape-wound core. But is it possible? Yes. The quickest way to get around it is not to use the core inside there. I agree. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a question in this area.
And one other thing I wanted to add here, we're not going to get too deep into it tonight, but my experimentation by way of a Wim Hof machine and a Van de Graaff generator, those are my favorite ways of making high voltage. Those are DC voltage machines. When you're operating with, let me pick a number, 200,000 volts DC, with very low capacitance and very low current, so it's relatively safe, but 2,000 volts DC, you get certain characteristics of air breakdown and arcing that are very, very different than with AC. A Tesla coil, the good news is it's a very simple circuit that gives you very high voltage. The bad news is a Tesla coil gives you AC voltage at, say, for instance, 1.5 megacycles of ring down of its secondary winding. And therefore, you don't get a chance to see the very difference between the positive lead and the negative lead of a high-voltage DC circuit. And when it comes to understanding what Mother Nature is telling you, there's a lot more information in DC than in AC, in my opinion. But I'm not always right. It's just an opinion. You had a further question, Wesley, and we got to keep it a little bit brief because we got to get back to Mel. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm very much appreciating that I can ask another question because I know that you have to handle your regular task. I am delivering about 20 kilohertz pulse square signal to the transformer. From the other side of the transformer, I'm getting, let's say, 6,000 volts, and this transformer is made on the ferrite cord, and then I'm delivering it to another coil, which actually is on permeability of 2,000 of the thyroids glued together, creating one cylinder. Now, this is around 135 windings with, let's say, number 18-gauge wire. Now, on the secondary of that, I have about five winds of the wire. I was actually experimenting with the thickness of the wire. Now, what happened is when I put the five winds, I'm able to power up the bulb. It's a 10-watt bulb, and it's giving me the bright light. But when I put, that's what was suggested in the literature, about 30 winds of the wire, this regards the thickness of the wire. I have a voltage. By the current, actually, it's so small, and there is no light from the light bulb back too.
Yeah, you're now talking about proper impedance matching of the power you're trying to couple, possibly from one Tesla coil to a second Tesla coil. That's one experiment you could be doing. When Mel is asking or answering the next question, I'm going to run in the other room and hopefully pick up this book that I've got, a very inexpensive paperback book, which tells you how to maximize the performance out of Tesla coils. Although it's not exactly on the subject you're talking about, it's going to give you some more information that's going to help. So I'm going to try to find that book on my bookshelf while Mel is giving us the next question. K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY again. All right, first of all, did we miss anybody? Because I know we had, there were two more people that had questions, and I'd like to get them in so that I don't get some emails. So please, anybody else? would like to ask a question, an individual question. Please come now, over.
As you can tell, I asked that earlier, Mel, and one or two of the people who signed in earlier apparently weren't able to hang in there. And so, if they come back next week, they'll be number one on the runway. I think you can go to your next item on your mailing list, and I'll go, I may be away from the rig, I may be away from the transmitter for about 60 seconds while I go over to my bookshelf and try to find this Tesla coil maximizing book. You got it, Mel.
Okay, well, that's why I say we should pick up the questions first before, you know, we spend so much time on one particular subject. I'd like to just cover everybody because it's not fair, really, you know, tell them to come back again next week and possibly face the same situation. I mean, we don't know who or what was called in. All right, but I'll apologize. If you're listening, please let me know, and if, as Dick says, if you let me know, I will make sure you go on the list as number one or number two. Well, in fact, let's see. I have a question. Yes, there's a question here, very good, that I think apropos to you, Dick. Are you in listening? First of all, I hope you're listening, over. Okay, this is away from the radio, but you can still hear. All right, this person writes that they were, a house was sold next door to me, two doors from me, and the new people came in, wanted to have the roof completely redone, and up on there was a 12-foot old parabolic, most like a TVRO type antenna, that was taken down by the roofer gently. He says enough because I had asked him that I'd like the antenna. Now, did I waste a couple of bucks giving it to him? Does the thing have any practical use that you know of? All I've got is the antenna, over. Okay, get the controller on the radio, so I'll have to hold that off again. I don't know if he heard that. I'll take one more standby. Did I miss anyone, please? If we missed anyone, please come now. I feel very bad that we don't get to all the people that signed in. So if you're still with us, please call in now. Guess not. Okay, so I'll have to wait for Dick to return because this surely is a subject that is most likely, as I say, dear to his heart. So Dick, as soon as you return, please pick it up.
Yeah, when I walk away from the rig, Mel, I carry a handy talkie with me. So I'm in the bookshelf two rooms away. I'm hearing everything you're saying, but with my handy talkie, I can't answer you. I'm too many miles away from the website, and I found the books I'm looking for. You had a question that you believe would be right up my alley, so go right ahead with that, and then I'll come back and I'll tell you these books that I found. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, the question was that the neighbor of this person, a ham, he said that there was a old parabolic dish up on the roof somewhere around 10, 12 foot one of the old, I guess, TVRO types. And they were, the house was sold, people came in, redoing the roof, had the roof redone, and he gave the roofer a couple of dollars to disconnect and unbolt the antenna because gently and so it can be taken down without wrecking it because they had to get it off the roof. And now he's got the possession of this this antenna, and he'd like to know what can he do with it because all he's got is the antenna, Dick, over.
I've collected a few of those myself, Mel, over the years. One of them is sitting up on my tower at the 60-foot level, and it's my satellite receiving system, TVRO, television receive-only type terminals that were popular in the late 80s and early 90s, so you could get direct broadcast satellite reception and see a whole lot of programming free of charge, as many as 300 channels worth of it. I've got to do some repair on that thing. I know that an awful lot of those channels have gone over to encryption, encoding technique, so a simple receiver receiving them today doesn't have anywhere near as easy a time. The bottom line of a parabolic dish is that the highest gain antenna in the world is a parabola. That's a 200-inch antenna at Mount Palomar, operating at optical frequencies, and it has a gain of something like 140 decibels, 130 decibels. I forget what the exact number is. You can read about that in the article I published in QST on the 12-foot stressed parabolic dish. That was August 1972, way back in the dark ages. But if you go to the, if you're an ARRL member and you go to the article archives, you can read about that 12-foot stress dish. As I said, it was August 1972 by K2RIW. And in the introductory paragraphs, I mentioned the highest gain antenna in the world. Let me drop. So the good news is a parabolic dish as an antenna, you can't top its gain. It's going to give you the maximum you're going to get. However, if you built a parabolic dish antenna and used it at 40 meters, you'd be wasting your time. Your simple wire dipole would have a zillion dB more gain. If the parabolic dish antenna is not a significant number of wavelengths in diameter at your operating frequency, you're probably wasting your time. For reasonable size parabolas, like the one you're talking about, it is not a very useful antenna below 1,000 megacycles. There's an exception to that. If you happen to be a serious moon bounce operator on the 70 centimeter band, 432, and somebody hands you a 28-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna made by the company in Massachusetts, I can't think of the name of them right now, yes, that's a very useful antenna. It's got 30 decibels of gain at 432. An 8-foot dish on 432 is not worth it. One simple Yagi, one long Yagi can give you the same gain. And it does it at 10% of the wind load and 5% of the cost and so on. So a parabolic dish, as you go up in frequency, the gain goes up 6 dB every time you double the frequency. So beyond 1,000 megacycles, a parabolic dish is a very good antenna. So that 8 or 10-foot dish on 1296, 2304, 3456, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, as long as it's got enough surface accuracy, that's a beautiful antenna. Below 1,000 megs for that diameter, probably not worth it. Do it as an experiment. You could also set it up as a radio telescope on, say, the 1420 megacycle hydrogen.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The 1420 megacycle hydrogen line. The dish would be quite useful there if you're setting up a radio telescope or even higher frequencies. But since every antenna made out of an aperture, that means a parabolic dish or a horn, since the gain is a function of the number of wavelengths across that aperture, below 1,000 megs for reasonable size antennas, probably not worth it. You think that's sort of the nature of the answer he's looking for, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, I assume he would like to know what, you know, what you would suggest doing with it, whether or not he should pursue it any further or just more or less, like he says, give it to scrap iron, you know, put it out for the garbage man, break it up and throw it out. So you would suggest possibly looking into maybe doing an experiment, as I think they once outlined, the how to get involved, like with the SETI project or on the amateur basis, or look into doing something in the 1296 or 2300 megahertz. In other words, you'd have to do quite a bit of work on it. I guess, where do you start? So you'd have to is it a standard part that you can replace for the feed horn or the homebrewer? Exactly, where do you go with this dish at this point? Does it pay to pursue in your estimate, Dick? Over.
That's for the network.
Depending on how scientifically oriented the guy is it worth pursuing? Absolutely. The nice thing about a parabolic dish is the surface itself, in theory, operates from DC to light. It is not frequency sensitive. A lot of people don't realize that. They think the parabolic surface with its focal length to diameter ratio, that really means depth of the parabola and its diameter, They think it only operates at certain frequencies. The dish itself is broadband and always focuses energy at the exact same point. The frequency range that the dish is operating at is only a function of the feed horn frequency range. To homebrew a feed horn out of simple pieces of sheet metal to a guy with